knew I was doing the right thing. Because you have a steadiness about you. And I believe in you. But it comes soon. And you must be smarter than your enemy.
What are you trying to say?
The Americans. They're very smart, but sometimes they can be incredibly stupid. They spend all this money and time and energy on the so-called war on terror. They put satellites up in space. They can ram a smart bomb up a camel's ass from a situation room 5,000 miles away. But every time the U.S. kills an Al-Qaeda leader, what happens? There's a new one before the body is cold. You do it a million times. They never get it because the real solution always eludes them.
What is?
Do nothing.
Nothing.
Nada. If you want to shut down a fundamentally flawed system, all you gotta do is step out of its way and it'll shut itself down. Nature has a way of correcting itself.
And I hope you understand that, boys and girls, on Monday morning. Well, actually, it's the afternoon now. Moon's Day, July 25th, 2016. And we're still there, P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your do-re-mi for your donation and send your letters. And if you'd like for me to forward anything to POWs, as far as mail is concerned, I'll do it for you. But I must read the letter. I will not forward any letter that somebody just hands me and says, send it in, because I'm not going to be a party to a prison break. Yeah, well, it's an overcast day here in Indiana, quite a bit of humidity, but not as bad as it was yesterday, so anyhow. Well, I see Hillary's getting her tit into the ringer even more and more and more and more with the help of the boys with the computers releasing all those emails. Yeah, Julian Assad, he's a hero. Yeah, those guys are good. I like them. And they're paying the price. Actually, they're very important soldiers in our chaos movement. Yeah, Operation Chaos. Moving along quite well. I'm going to have to dig out that book, Jew, Gypsy, and Islam. You know, I don't think I've ever read that book. I've had it in my library for a long time, and shame on me. I should have read it. I'm going to dig that out. And if it's real good, I'll let you know where we can get some more of them. Incidentally, Matt Hale contacted me and wanted me to look in on his book that he wrote. And I said, well, yeah, send me one. I'll send you the money. And if I really like it, I'll promote it. And in fact, I'll send it to some POWs and like that. But I had to be honest with him. Until I read it, I wouldn't promote it. I wouldn't promote any book that I hadn't read. Well, most of the time. One good thing is Matt Hale, we know he's not pushing religion. Unless it's the race, religion of the race. Yeah, like Ben Klassen. Oh, Matt's not that far from me now. He's down here at Terre Haute, Indiana. I call it Terre Haute. And that's where a lot of our guys have been. That's where David Lane was murdered by the system. So it's not that far away. I would say about 100 miles. So I might get down there and see old Matt one of these days. Yeah. We don't agree on everything, but it's all right. I'll support him. Support people when they're down. That's for sure. Of course, we've got a handful of people in the prisons now that we support as much as possible, usually around $25 a month, and they're real appreciative of that because hardly anybody ever gives any money to POWs. It's a sad situation. However, on the regular POWs, if they want information, and I'll send them information. I'll send them even a book once in a while. They need to send me stamps, you know, like 5 or 10 stamps a month, just to show that they're legitimate and they're willing to do something, you know. And most of them do that, yeah. So they send me a letter and I send back and say, look, you got to send me some stamps to show you're really into the program here. I'm not going to give it to you free. Like the other week or so ago, I sent this thick envelope, business envelope. It cost me $1 or $2 to send it out to a POW that said, oh, I got to have information. And I got it back refused. And we can't afford to spend your donations like that. So that's why I have to demand stamps or cash if they got it. Some people in prison have money. Not a lot, but some, not a lot of them, but the people in prison have money. Some of them have a lot of money. But I've never had one of those kind of guys on my list. I've had guys that had a little more than normal, but never a fat cat like a politician in prison. No, I never had run into one of those guys. Well, I got my new sign up out front, my 4x8 with my 8-inch letters. Looks real good. Replaceable letters, plastic letters. And it says on there this week, it says, don't blame Russia, blame the bitch. Now, of course, some of these people around here are not going to understand what the hell that means. And if they don't understand what it means, I don't want to communicate with them anyhow, because it's not that hard to figure out, because everybody's trying to blame Russia for leaking these emails. Well, even if it was, so what? So what? Don't pick on Russia. They want to get a new Cold War going, because how are they going to sell more arms and so forth? The Cold War was a very lucrative thing. I mean, you know, billions and billions, maybe trillions, were made off of that Cold War. And all those nukes got built. None of them got dropped. Well, that's good. They didn't get dropped, but still there were trillions of dollars in research and nuclear weapons just sitting there. We need to get rid of them, that's for sure. I had one of my contacts call me last night, and he said, this must be like going to heaven, huh? I said, yeah. Obama's brother supporting Trump and somebody dumping all these emails on the bitch. I couldn't ask for anything better. Things are going great. The chaos factor and 100th monkey are in full gear, man. We were having a great time talking about it. I see our daily shootout has happened again. Another bunch of Negroes shooting it up. You'd think people would get the message pretty soon. Almost all of these shootouts, if not all of them, are blacks on blacks. Nobody wants to talk about that. They just want to get together and pray. Yeah, right. Like that's going to bring somebody back to life. The only reason I can figure out they want to pray is because they want to pray that they don't get shot. And there's a good chance, if you live in the ghetto, so-called ghetto, it's not really a ghetto, it's self-imposed neighborhoods of black people, you're going to get shot sooner or later. It may take time. I watched a short movie on 45 minutes to an hour last night. It was on Amazon. It was called Polite People. And somebody had gone over there to eastern Ukraine, western Russia, and made a movie, documentary, about these guys that joined up to fight over there. It was sort of a screwed up mess, just like I figured it would be when I advised people not to get involved in that shit over in Donbass and so forth. There were some good guys and good racial guys in the film. They even come from Brazil. A guy from Brazil was very white and everything. But they've had assassinations within their own groups and everything else over there. And then they all are always trying to find the group that corresponds more to their liking and their background, too. So they're changing that all the time. And now that there's supposedly a ceasefire, they're just sitting around twiddling their thumbs. But anyhow, the cameraman went out with them on patrols and stuff, and it didn't look much like a war to me. It was just sort of a boring, casual, maybe once in a while somebody'd fire a shot at somebody. Once in a great while, some guy'd get wounded and like that, and pretty much ended up, they're all sitting there scratching their ass and wondering what the hell they're doing there, and also the problem they had getting there. These guys had a hell of a time just getting to where the battle was, whether they went through England or, whether they went through France or Germany or Russia, where they had problems at the border and all that kind of stuff. So I knew that's what the whole thing would be like over there, and that's why I recommended people stay away from that stuff. Same way with these guys that are going over there to join up with ISIS. It's ridiculous. It's suicide. But the neo-Nazis, the Hollywood Nazis, got all excited about it. But they talked a little bit about that in this film, but not much. Not much. A lot of those guys that went over there, they weren't that interested in National Socialism. Some of them were oldness, too, so anyhow, that's another interesting thing. But anyhow, if you get up there on Amazon, you can find it. It's boring, but interesting. I ran into a series that was on, was first put out by, I believe, the Sky Network over in England. And it also ran on Cinemax. It's called Strike Back. And it's really a hot one, I'll tell you. It's about a special crew of people that are strictly involved in dropping in and rescuing people or assassinating people. And it leaves no holes unbarred, I'll tell you. I never seen so much shooting and automatic weapons in my life. Yeah. You might be able to find it in a video rental store, I don't know. Sometimes they rent out whole series on CDs. I mean DVDs. Yeah, that series is available also on Amazon. I think a couple of seasons of it. Probably 10, 15 shows a piece. It'll keep you out of trouble. You can watch everybody else kill everybody. You don't have to kill anybody. Of course, in real life, these guys would have been dead several times over. But anyhow, they're real balls of the wall. You wonder how these unstable people that have obvious mental problems get into trouble. Watching stuff like this. I mean, if you're a level-headed person, it's no problem. But I can see a lot of these guys that they've picked up for shooting up a bunch of people, watching these things and playing these war games and so forth. What do they expect? Then they blame it on the white supremacists. Or even the Islamic extremists, you know. I don't think until they get over here and start watching, or get over in France and England and start watching these wild-ass TV shows, do they get all excited. Incidentally, it does no good to prop up these so-called nations in the Middle East. See, remember what caused all this shit, and I've talked about this before. The First World War, which was really started by a bunch of moronic monarchs and guys, sociopaths, that killed millions and millions of white people. And in the process, they destroyed the Ottoman Empire, which the Ottoman Empire worked quite well. It was pretty peaceful in the Middle East at the time. Well, then in the, after the World War I and they destroyed the Ottoman Empire, all these countries in Europe, white countries, came in there and split up the turf for whatever they could get out of it and put a line around the piece of land on the map. All of a sudden they had a nation, not considering how that worked out with the culture and the race and so forth and the religion. They just arbitrarily did that, not only in the Middle East but down through Africa, which they should have known was an insane proposition that would sooner or later fall apart. It's been falling apart ever since. The only way you can solve any problem in the Middle East is Western countries pull out and let these people reestablish their tribal grounds and all that kind of stuff. Let them, the ones that are uprising in these countries in the Middle East, fine, uprise. And get rid of the nation and go back to what they had under the Ottoman Empire. Which is, in some ways is what ISIS was trying to do. However, I don't think their motives were as pure as the Ottomans. But still, you pull back and let them fight it out. If you pull back and take all the wild-ass weapons out of there, they wouldn't have much to fight with. But then how would the arms makers make a fortune off of these people? Got to trade them something for their oil and stuff like that. And, of course, if we had not been involved in the Middle East all those years, I'm sure that the technology of the West, so-called West or white countries, would have developed different forms of energy, you know. Some we probably haven't even heard of, but if we hadn't wasted all the technology and time on warfare, we probably could have developed all kinds of energy producing programs. And if we hadn't, if Germany hadn't wasted their lifeblood on World War II and World War I, the genius of the German mind could have helped develop all this stuff. Anyhow, like I say, the white race has brought it all on themselves. All on themselves. So they go, they rise up over there, and then we go over there and destroy everything. Not a house, not a block standing on a block. And then what do? We're our own worst enemy. Then they all invade Europe. I'm getting out of here, man. They knocked my house down. I got no place to live, and I don't want to live in a tent. Might as well make it over to Europe, see? Then people say, why are they all coming over here? Why are they all coming over there? Shit. We're our own worst enemy, or our leaders are our own worst enemy, and that's why I believe in the breakup. I do believe in the breakup of the whole damn thing. Sooner the better. Sooner the better. That's right. Does that make me an anarchist? Well, maybe it does. A racial anarchist? Maybe so. I don't really give a shit what they call me. As long as something good happens with our race one of these days. In the meantime, I'm waiting for Bernie's people to go crazy. Bernie's too soft. Bernie backs down. But his followers, the people who built him up to vote for him, they're not. I think they're going to raise holy hell. And that's good. I support that. Anytime the people rise up against the system, I'm all for it. And the blacks in the black ghetto rise up against the crap in the black ghetto, that's fine. white working people rise up in the white areas of the country, that's fine. It's the only way we're going to get any place. It's not going to be done overnight. It's going to take quite a while. We may be into the next century. In the meanwhile, maybe somebody can figure a way for me to get out of here and go to Mars or something. I think I could handle peace and quiet and room full of books. Maybe a few movies. Staring out over the red planet. Yeah, I could handle that. Now I'm going to read from a book here that separates the lone wolves from what I call the era of crowds. This is Gustave Le Bon, The Crowd. Now, this book is a textbook in most universities, but most people never learn anything about it, or never learn to follow it, or learn anything. They still go by the crowd method, just like these conventions, like this convention tonight. That's going to be a real clusterfuck, I'll tell you that. They're going to have all the mothers of all the blacks that have been shot down by the cops. Why don't they have all the mothers of all the black guys who've been shot down by black guys? Hell, that would fill the whole city of Philadelphia, man. Right there on our stage. The great upheavals which precede changes of civilization, such as the fall of the Roman Empire and the foundation of the Arabian Empire, seem at first sight determined more specifically by political transformations, foreign invasion, or the overthrow of dynasties. But a more attentive study of these events shows that behind their apparent causes, the real cause is generally seen to be a profound modification in the ideas of the peoples. The true historical upheavals are not those which astonish us by their grandeur and violence. The only important changes, whence the renewal of civilization results, affect ideas, conceptions, and beliefs. The memorial events of history are the visible effects of the invisible changes of human thought. The reason these great events are so rare is that there is nothing so stable in a race as the inherited groundwork of its thoughts. The present epoch is one of these critical moments in which the thought of mankind is undergoing a process of transformation. Two fundamental factors are at the base of this transformation. I see I've underlined a couple of sentences here. The first is the destruction of those religious, political, and social beliefs in which all the elements of our civilization are rooted. Gee, seems like that's going on right now, isn't it? The second is the creation of entirely new conditions of existence and thought as the result of modern scientific and industrial discoveries. The ideas of the past, although half destroyed, being still very powerful, and the ideas which are to replace them being still in process of formation. The modern age represents a period of transition and anarchy. It's not easy to say as yet what will one day be evolved from this necessarily somewhat chaotic period. What will be the fundamental ideas on which the societies that are to succeed our own will be built up? We do not at present know. Still, it is already clear that on whatever lines the societies of the future are organized, they will have to count on a new power with the last surviving sovereign force of modern times, the power of crowds. On the ruins of so many ideas, formerly considered beyond discussion, and today decaying of the so many sources of authority that successive revolutions have destroyed, this power, which alone has arisen in their stead, seems soon destined to absorb the others. While all of our ancient beliefs are tottering and disappearing, while the old pillars of society are giving way one by one, The power of the crowd is the only force that nothing menaces, and of which the prestige is continually on the increase. The age we are about to enter will in truth be the era of crowds. Scarcely a century ago, the traditional policies of European states and the rivalries of sovereigns were the principal factors of shaping events. The opinion of the masses scarcely counted, and most frequently, indeed, did not count at all. Today, it is the traditions which used to obtain in politics and the individual tendencies and rivalries of rulers which do not count, while on the contrary, the voice of the masses have become preponderant. It is this voice that dictates their conduct to kings, whose endeavor is to take note of its utterances. The destinies of nations are elaborate at present in the heart of the masses, and no longer in the councils of the princes. The entry of the popular classes into political life, that is to say, in reality, their progressive transformation into governing classes, is one of the most striking characteristics of our epoch of transition. The introduction of universal suffrage or voting, which exercised for a long time but little influence, is not, as might be thought, the distinguishing feature of this transference of political power. The progressive growth of the power of the masses took place at first by the propagation of certain ideas, which have slowly implanted themselves in men's minds, and afterwards by the gradual association of individuals bent on bringing about the realization of theoretical conceptions. It is by association that crowds have come to procure ideas with respect to their interests, which are very clearly defined, if not particularly just, and have arrived at a consciousness of their strength. The masses are founding syndicates before which the authorities capitulate one after another. They're also founding labor unions, which in spite of all economic laws tend to regulate the conditions of labor and wages. They return to assemblies in which the government is invested, representatives utterly lacking initiative and independence, and reduced most often to nothing else than the spokesmen of the committees that have chosen them. Today, the claims of the masses are becoming more and more sharply defined, and amount to nothing less than a determination to destroy utterly society as it now exists, with a view of making it hark back to the primitive communism which was the normal condition of all groups before the dawn of civilization. Limitations of the hours of labor, nationalization of mines, railways, factories, and of soil, the equal distribution of all products, the elimination of all the upper classes for the benefit of the popular classes, and so on, such are these claims. Little adapted to reasoning, crowds, on the contrary, are quick to act. As a result of their present organization, their strength has become immense. The dogmas whose birth we are witnessing will soon have the force of the old dogmas, that is to say, tyrannical and sovereign forces of being above discussion. The divine right of the masses is about to replace the divine right of kings. The writers who enjoy the favor of our middle classes, those who best represent their rather narrow ideas, their somewhat prescribed views, their rather superficial skepticism, and then at times somewhat excessive egoism, display profound alarm at this new power which they see growing. And to combat the disorder in men's minds, they are addressing despairing appeals to those moral forces of the church for which they formerly professed so much disdain. They talk to us of the bankruptcy of science, go back in penitence to Rome, and remind us of the teaching of revealed truth. These new converts forget it is too late. Had they been really touched by grace, a like operation could not have been the same influence on minds less concerned with the preoccupation which beset these recent adherents to religion. The masses repudiate today the gods which their admonishers repudiate yesterday and help them destroy. There is no power, divine or human, that can oblige a stream to flow back to its source. Brings me to a thought, you know. Some of the thinkers are saying that the West is no longer based on religion. There's still quite a bit of religion left, Christian religion left, but that's not what it's based on. It's based upon secularism in all its forms. So all you people out there that think that Christianity is going to save the day, forget that. That's long over. There's been no bankruptcy of science, and science has had no share in the present intellectual anarchy, nor in the making of new power which is springing up in the midst of this anarchy. Science promised us truth, or at least knowledge of such relations as our intelligence can seize. It never promised us peace or happiness, sovereignty, indifferent to our feelings. It is deep to our lamentations. It is for us to endeavor to live with science, since nothing can bring back the illusions it has destroyed. Universal symptoms, visible in all nations, show us the rapid growth and power of crowds, and do not admit of our supposing that it is destined to cease growing at an early date. Whatever fate it may reserve for us, we shall have to submit to it. All reasoning against it is mere vain war of words. Certainly it is a possibility that the advent to power of the masses marks one of the last stages of Western civilization. A complete return to those periods of confused anarchy, which seem always destined to precede the birth of every new society. But may this result be prevented? Up to now, these thoroughgoing destructions of a worn-out civilization have constituted the most obvious task of the masses. It is not indeed today merely that this can be traced. History tells us that from the moment when the moral forces on which a civilization rested have lost their strength, its final dissolution is brought about by those unconscious and brutal crowds known justifiably enough as barbarians. Civilizations as yet have only been created and directed by a small intellectual aristocracy, never by crowds. Crowds are only powerful for destruction. Their rule is always tantamount to a barbarian phase. A civilization involves fixed rules, discipline, a passing from the instinctive to the rational state, forethought for the future, an elevated degree of culture, all of them conditions that crowds left to themselves have invariably shown themselves incapable of realizing. In consequence of the purely destructive nature of their power, crowds act like those microbes which hasten the dissolution of the enfeebled or dead bodies. When the structure of a civilization is rotten, it is always the masses that bring about its downfall. It is at such a juncture their chief mission is plainly visible, and that for a while the philosophy of number seems the only philosophy of history. Is the same fate in store for our civilization? There is ground to fear that this is the case, but we are not as yet in a position to be certain of it. Well, considering this book was written quite a long time ago, I think we're pretty well understanding of it by now. However this may be, we are bound to resign ourselves to the reign of the masses, since want of foresight has in succession overthrown all barriers that might have kept the crowd in check. We have a very slight knowledge of these crowds, which are beginning to be the object of so much discussion. professional students of psychology have lived far from them, have always ignored them, and when, as of late, they have turned their attention in this direction, it has only been to consider the crimes crowds are capable of committing. Without a doubt, criminal crowds exist, but virtuous and heroic crowds and crowds of many other kinds are also to be met with. The crimes of crowds only constitute a particular phase of their psychology. The mental constitution of crowds is not to be learned merely by a study of their crimes, any more than that of an individual by a mere description of his vices. However, in point of fact, all world's masters, all the founders of religions and empires, the apostles of all beliefs, eminent statesmen, and, in a more modest sphere, the mere chiefs of small groups of men, have always been unconscious psychologists, possessed of an instinctive and often very sure knowledge of the character of crowds, and it is their accurate knowledge of this character that has enabled them so easily to establish their mastery. Napoleon had marvelous insight into the psychology of the masses of the country over which he reigned, but he at times completely misunderstood the psychology of crowds belonging to other races, and it is because he thus misunderstood it that he engaged in Spain and notably in Russia in conflicts in which his power received blows which were destined within a brief space of time to ruin it. And knowledge of the psychology of crowds is today the most last resource of the statesman who wishes not to govern them. That is becoming a very difficult matter, but at any rate not to be too much governed by them. If you'll notice at the Trump speech at the convention, the crowd situation was typical. Now, he was saying, there was a lot of things he said in that speech that if you approached an individual conservative or so-called right-winger, he wouldn't like it. He'd say, you're nuts. He'd say, that's counterproductive. But you didn't hear it because the mass mind, the crowd, they got all excited emotionally. And we're going on and on. He could have led them into the streets and told them to burn down the town, and they'd have done it. It is only by obtaining some sort of insight into the psychology of crowds that it can be understood how slight is the action upon them of laws and institutions, how powerless they are to hold any opinions other than those which are imposed upon them. And that is not the rules based on theories and pure equity that they are to be led, but by seeking what produces an impression on them, what seduces them. For instance, should a legislature wishing to impose a new tax choose that which would be theoretically the most just? By no means. In practice, the most unjust may be the best for the masses. Should it at the same time be the least obvious, and apparently the least burdensome, it will be the most easily tolerated. It is for this reason that an indirect tax, however exorbitant it be, will always be accepted by the crowd, because being paid daily in fractions of a farthing on objects of consumption, it will not interfere with the habits of the crowd and will pass unperceived. Yeah. Replace it by a proportional tax on wages or income of any other kind to be paid in a lump sum, and were this new imposition theoretically 10 times less burdensome than the other, it would give rise to a unanimous protest. This arises from the fact that a sum relatively high, which will appear immense and will in consequence strike the imagination, has been substituted for the unperceived fractions of a farthing. The new tax would only appear light had it been saved farthing by farthing. by this economic proceeding involves an amount of foresight in which the masses are incapable. The example which precedes is one of the simplest. Its oppositeness will easily perceive. It did not escape the attention of such a psychologist as Napoleon, but our modern legislators, ignorant as they are of the characteristics of a crowd, are unable to appreciate it. Experience has not taught them as yet to sufficient degree that men never shape their conduct upon the teaching of pure reason. Many other practical applications might be made of psychology of crowds, and knowledge of this science throws the most vivid light on a great number of historical and economic phenomena totally incomprehensible without it. I shall have occasion to show that the reason why the most remarkable of modern historians, Taney, has at times so imperfectly understood the events of the great French Revolution is that it never occurred to him to study the genius of the crowd. He took as his guide in the study of this complicated period the descriptive method resorted to by naturalists. But the moral forces are almost absent in the case of the phenomenon which naturalists have to study. Yet it is precisely these forces that constitute the true mainspring of history. In consequence, merely looked at from a practical side, the study of the psychology of crowds deserves to be attempted, were its interest in resulting from pure curiosity only. It would still merit attention. It is as interesting to decipher the motives of actions of men as to determine the characteristics of a mineral or a plant. Our study of the genius of crowds can merely be a brief synthesis, a simple summary of our investigations. Nothing more must be demanded of it than a few suggestive views. Others will work the ground more thoroughly. Today we only touch the surface of a still almost virgin soil. Now that's the end of the introduction to the Mind of Crowds by Le Bon, which every one of you should read, or if you haven't read it, because that will lead you directly from Freud's son-in-law. What was his name? LeBay? No, not LeBay, but anyhow, the father of American public indoctrination to buy things. Yeah. And that guy probably has done more damage to Western white culture than any man that lived. Because his same tactics of convincing people to buy things they don't want are the same tactics that he is able to convince people to go to war that they don't need. And they have nothing to gain from it. In fact, lose everything from it. Well, I see Trump has rebuked David Duke. How many times has he done that? The press keep throwing it up to him and he keeps biting the hook. Trump never knows when to shut up. Just shut up. Don't talk about David Duke. Now that David Duke's going to run for Senate. Oh boy, here we go again. Well, if he keeps trying, one of these days he'll get the gold circle on the merry-go-round. And once he's gotten into a senatorial or a congressional job, he'll be long gone, boys and girls. Well, there's some more about the Kenyan half-brother of the Democratic U.S. President Barack Obama has walked away from his brother's party. You probably heard all about this by now. More to the point, Malik Obama, a Democrat, told the Post from his home in the village of Kagilo that he voted this year for Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. The reason, his deep disappointment in his brother's administration and the scandal over Hillary Clinton's use of private email servers during her tenure as Secretary of State. Quote, she should have known better as the custodian of classified information, unquote, the 58-year-old Negro former Democrat said. He expressed exasperation over the decision by FBI Director James Comey not to recommend prosecution over the matter. Rather, photographed sporting a red hat with white letters saying, Make America Great Again, Malik Obama told the media he switched allegiance to the party of Lincoln instead. I like Donald Trump because he speaks from the heart, he said. Make America Great Again is a great slogan. I would like to meet him. Well, I'm sure you're probably going to get to meet him. So there you go. You know, it's a wonder these presidents haven't any of them ever committed suicide. I think if I was going all this bullshit and I was Obama, I'd surely think about it. Well, here's a little interesting stuff I picked up out of the Jew News, Israeli, actually. Rejecting decades-old policy, the Republican Party approved on July 12th a 2016 platform that does not include a call for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We believe that the establishment of a Palestinian state on the West Bank would be destabilizing and harmful to the peace process. Whose peace? 1980 Republican platform that brought Ronald Reagan to the White House. We oppose the creation of an independent Palestine state. Its establishment is inimical to the security interests of Israel, Jordan, and the U.S. We will not support the creation of any Palestinian entity that could place Israel's security in jeopardy. 1988, Republican platform that brought George W. Bush, H.W. Bush, to the White House. Yeah. These three excerpts, planned over a quarter of a century, relating to the GOP's attitude towards the establishment of a Palestinian state, include two important lessons for Israel. Breathtaking erosion. One of these lessons relates to the past and the other to the future. Israel will ignore either at its peril or at least to its grave detriment. With regard to the past, these excerpts underscore the breathtaking erosion that's taken place since the late 1980s in the GOP's opposition to Palestinian statehood. From utter rejection to retraction of opposition in 1996 to explicit, all but conditioned endorsement in 2002. It is only now that the GOP is setting aside its ill-considered support and has thankfully begun to revert, albeit it's still partially, to its former position. What makes this spectacular erosion from the unconditional rejection to conditional acceptance even more remarkable is the fact that it took place over a period in which, for the overwhelmingly greater proportion of time, the incumbent Israel government was headed by Likud, which until the mid-2009 explicitly opposed the establishment of the Palestinian state. Indeed, for the 22 years beginning in 1980 to 2002, Likud-led coalitions were in power for about double the time Labor-led ones were. This is clearly a grave indictment of Israel's rights, inability to convincingly convince the validity of its political credo, and to undermine that of its ideological adversaries on the left. The need for soul-searching, the gravity of this indictment, is further compounded by two factors that make it even more alarming. The first is the dismal outcome of emerging despite the highly favorable point of departure which opponents of Palestinian statehood enjoy. After all, no effort was required to win over the GOP to this rejectionist position, for it was a priori staunchly behind it to begin with. Yet, despite this, the right was unable to sustain this like-minded support, which by 2002 had, for all intents and purposes, been totally eroded. Wow. The second is that this erosion occurred despite the fact that the right's opposition to Palestinian statehood was completely validated by facts on the ground by the bloody events that tragically arose from the fatally failed attempt to implement it. So sadly, the right was not able to marshal the distinct dual advantage it had of a highly favorable point of departure and overwhelming empirical collaboration of its credo to sustain the GOP's natural inclination to oppose the establishment of the Palestinian state. This in itself is reason enough for the intense soul-searching among the right-wing activists, but it's acquired even greater pertinence and urgency precisely because of the encouragement signs that the GOP is reverting at least partially and cautiously to its past position of opposition to Palestinian statehood. Well, there you go. The Republican Party is moving right on the subject, an anti-Palestinian state. And guess who is promoting that? Donald Trump. All those right-wingers out there that think Donald Trump's going to be the best thing since sliced bread better think about it, because he's 100% in bed with the Israeli state. And if you care anything about the Palestinians, which I'm not saying I do that much, if you care much about it, you'll see what's going on. And if you're going along with the Republican Party and call yourself your anti-Zionist or whatever you are, you're kidding yourself. You are kidding yourself. And they email me all the time about how happy they are with Trump and he's going to take care of those Jews. Well, one thing we got now, we got this Wasserman. She's like a Zionist. And Bernie is like a, what is he? I had it all on the tip of my tongue. Bernie's sort of like Rockwell used to say. He's more of a tame Jew. He's not our friend, but he don't know what to do now. He'd really like just to go back to the Senate and slouch back and go to sleep. But he's in the middle of this, and he's being moved along by the currents of his own movement that's behind him. And the people want to tear the Democrat leadership apart, and Bernie's trying to calm it down and just go back to being a senator. So Bernie's actions didn't accomplish near as much as Trump's actions is as far as recruiting millions of people and new people into the Republican Party. And you can't say that Bernie has achieved that kind of a goal with the Democrat Party, even though a lot of young people have joined up, but not near what has joined up the Republican Party, which was the game in the first place, I keep telling you. It's the game in the first place was to get millions of new blood into the Republican Party because it was dying. It was the Whig Party. A lot of people out there don't realize that the Mexican economy is going great now. Their stock market is going up, 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 and ours is going down, down, down. And there's more Mexicans leaving the United States now than coming in. I don't know whether you saw the latest, but Uncle Scammy lost a ton of weaponry into the Middle East, just like he lost those billion-dollar stacks of money a few years ago. Remember that? When they were actually playing football with stacks of money over there in Iraq? Well, now they've lost tremendous numbers of weapons. They wonder why the so-called bad guys have the weapons. You know, the so-called bad guys are luckier than hell because they've got such an incompetent adversary. Listen to this about these the loss of these weapons.
These weapons potentially ending up in the hands of extremists, is it a consequence that the U.S. is willing to accept in order to prop up rebel forces in Syria?
As it's an ongoing investigation, I just don't have a comment on that report.
It's a policy. It's not the only red flag out there.
Hi, there was a joint Al Jazeera, New York Times report, rather I should say New York Times Al Jazeera report, alleging that some members of the Jordanian intelligence structure may have taken weapons intended for rebels fighting against the Assad regime and sold those weapons on the black market. What is this building's reaction? What conversations has it had with the Jordanian government? We all know that weapons turn up on the black market all the time, but given the complexity of the situation in Syria, it does raise some alarm bells.
Okay, so thanks for the question. We have no comment on that report. There is an ongoing investigation. The United States remains committed to Jordan's security and stability, and we're proud to stand side by side with Jordan in the global counter-ISIL coalition. But on that particular report, there's an ongoing investigation. I just can't speak to it, Ross.
The CIA does not comment either on its covert transfers of weapons, and yet it is a U.S. government policy. Who else should we ask about this?
As I said, I have no comment on that.
More of a policy. These weapons potentially ending up in the hands of extremists, is it a consequence that the U.S. is willing to accept in order to prop up rebel forces in Syria?
As it's an ongoing investigation, I just don't have a comment on that report.
It's a policy. It's not the only red flag out there. For example, last September, the Pentagon acknowledged that the Syrian rebels that it trained gave at least a quarter of their weapons cache to al-Nusra. How many red flags do there have to be for the U.S. to stop arming rebels?
So we're going to leave it where I left it. Matt, you had a question?
Yeah, who's doing the investigation?
It's actually an interagency investigation, but the State Department is contributing to it.
So what are the other agencies involved?
Yeah, I can't speak to all the different agencies, but it's multiple U.S. agencies. We're contributing information.
Well, she does make a good point. Hold on, just one thing.
The White House was just asked about this in their briefing, right?
I believe they were.
Yeah. You know what they did?
They refused to comment on it.
No. They referred the questions to the State Department and to the FBI.
Yeah. So, and on this, I'm saying there's an ongoing investigation.
But you won't even say who's doing the investigation?
It's my understanding. It's interagency. It's multiple government aid. I don't have a rundown of who exactly. If I have anything more, we'll come back to you on that.
I'm going to hold my breath.
Hold on 1 second.
How long should I hold it?
Probably not until the end of the briefing. Mm-hmm. Saeed?
I wanted to ask you, there were also allegations that these weapons were actually used to kill Americans, American trainers, and so on in Jordan. Can you comment on that?
It's ongoing. I really can't say it. I'm sorry. Okay.
She was touching on a really good point.
Yeah.
Is there any reason why the U.S. government should be in the business of providing weapons to anyone who is not a part of a nation state's military? Because it seems every time that some rebel group gets its hands on U.S. provided weapons, they end up in the wrong hands. They end up being sold for, you know, whatever, on the black market. Is this something that U.S. foreign policy and military policy really should even be considering?
I know you'd like a comment on it, Roz. I just can't at this point. If we have more that I can offer on it, you know, we certainly will.
But just in general terms, is this really a good idea?
Say it. Are we done? Nope, I don't think so.
No, but this isn't about that. This
okay.
is a,
well,
this
Hold
is somewhat
on, and then
related.
I'll go to you.
Well, the U.S. government and the idiots in the State Department and the military-industrial complex, well, they don't care because that makes a lot of money for people. The U.S. government has a habit of losing weapons in Syria. Where did they go? I put Rastas in charge. It happened too often all around the world. You have to wonder if these accidents are on purpose. Well, of course they're on purpose. Even the government is investigating itself on this one, but don't ask the White House or the State Department for details. They don't want to even say who is doing the investigation. Watch this stream of pathetic no comments from a State Department spokesman, which I just played. It's insane. Your government is an insane asylum. run by mobsters. Period. That's it. It's over. It's just a matter of time. It's crumbling, the whole mess. Oh, man. I'll be back tomorrow on Tuesday, and we'll do it again. I'll see if I can find any sane people in this country. Meanwhile, I'm going to fix me a drink and watch these crazy people at the Democrat convention just for laughs.